Today we will be doing, we'll be walking through the A4 amendment to Senate File 2483, which is our omnibus higher education bill. The only items on the agenda today are the walkthrough from nonpartisan staff and public testimony, and we will not take any legislative action on the bill or amendments today. On Thursday, we'll meet to consider the additional amendments and vote on referral of the omnibus to the Finance Committee. With that, I'll turn it over to nonpartisan staff. Ms. Bursch, would you please begin by walking us through the spreadsheet?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, my colleague Tom Watson and I are going to walk you through the A4 amendment to Senate File 2483, otherwise known as the Chair's 2025 Budget Recommendations for the Higher Education Committee. I'll start with Article 1, the appropriations article, and the corresponding spreadsheet, and then pass it over to Mr. Watson to finish with Article 2, the policy article. So in your packets, you should have a spreadsheet titled Chair's 2025 Budget Recommendations in the upper left-hand corner. This spreadsheet documents the appropriations and transfers for every line item in Article 1 of the A4, as well as the estimated fiscal impacts of the policy items in Article 2 for those that have them. And as a reminder, all dollars in this spreadsheet are in thousands. So lines 1 through 34 of the spreadsheet show a high-level overview of expenses and revenues by fund for the Office of Higher Education, the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities, the University of Minnesota, and the Mayo Clinic. I'll talk about that briefly before I move on to a more detailed line item review. The A4 proposes a total general fund budget of $4,071,092,000 in the 26-27 biennium and $3,995,156,000 in the 28-29 biennium. This reflects a $101 million net increase in general fund expenses and an offsetting $1 million one-time increase in general fund revenues in the 26-27 biennium, and a $25 million net increase in general fund expenses in the 28-29 biennium. At the top right of the page, you can see the Higher Education Committee has a general fund target of $100 million in fiscal years 25 through 27, and $25 million in fiscal years 28-29, which these budget recommendations net to exactly. The A4 also proposes an increase in special revenue fund expenses and revenues of $682,000 per biennium and maintains the base level of healthcare access fund expenses at $4,134,000 per biennium. So columns I, N, and S summarize the changes in expenses and revenues from the base set by the February forecast. And columns J, O, and T summarize the change from the governor's revised recommendations that were released last month. I'll largely be focusing on the former for the line item review, the changes from base, since that's the reference point for the targets. And for the sake of this walkthrough, you should assume that all changes are in the general fund unless stated otherwise, just because that's the case for everything but one item. So starting on row 36 with the Office of Higher Education, the A4 proposes total direct general fund expenses of $827,791,000 in the 26-27 biennium, which reflects a $102,650,000 increase over base, and a $752,844,000 in the 28-29 biennium, which reflects a $27.65 million increase over base. There's also a proposed increase in total special revenue fund statutory appropriations and revenues of $682,000 per biennium. So on line 38, there's a $104,520,000 increase in the 26-27 biennium and a $29,354,000 increase in the 28-29 biennium for the state grant program, both of which are above the $15 million per biennium increase recommended by the governor. These changes are also coupled with state grant program parameter changes in Article 2 that Mr. Watson will cover when we get there. On line 39, there's a $2 million per biennium increase for the child care grant program. On line 40, there's an $800,000 per biennium decrease for the state work-study program. On line 48, the $90,000 per biennium appropriation for the Minnesota Education Equity Partnership is eliminated. On line 50, the $1,002,000 per biennium appropriation for the United Family Medicine Residency Program is eliminated. On line 51, there's a $1 million per biennium increase for Minitex. This is a modified version of Senator Putnam's Senate File 2729, which was introduced but not heard in committee. On line 53, the $1,290,000 per biennium appropriation for Hennepin Healthcare graduate family medical education is eliminated. On line 55, I just want to note that eliminating the summer academic enrichment program was proposed in the governor's revised recommendations, but the A4 maintains that program at the base level of funding. On line 56, the $50,000 per biennium appropriation for campus sexual assault reporting appears to be eliminated, but it's actually been consolidated into the agency administration line item on line 87. So that's a net zero change. This reporting work is statutorily required, so the session law rider isn't necessary to ensure that the Office of Higher Education will complete it. On line 58, there appears to be a $6,058,000 per biennium decrease for emergency assistance for post-secondary students grants, but there's just been an adjustment to how the existing base funding is appropriated, so that is also a net zero change. This is from Senator Umover-Bayton's Senate File 2406 as amended. The portion of the EAPS funding that was previously distributed to the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities and the University of Minnesota through OHE is now being directly appropriated to each system, so that funding has just been relocated to their respective sections in the spreadsheet. On line 60, there is a $1 million per biennium decrease for the underrepresented student teacher grant program. On line 65, there's a $100,000 per biennium increase for student loan debt counseling grants. This is from Senator Umover-Bayton's Senate File 1611. On line 66, there appears to be a $1.6 million per biennium decrease to the Hunger Free Campus program, but in a similar way to the Emergency Assistance for Post-Secondary Students grants, there's just been an adjustment to how the existing base funding is appropriated, so it's a net zero change. This is from Senator Putnam's Senate File 2481 as amended. The portion of the Hunger Free Campus funding that was previously distributed to the University of Minnesota and MinState through OHE is just now being directly appropriated to them. So that portion will be in their sections as well. On line 67, there is an $8 million per biennium increase for the Fostering Independence Grant Program. On line 69, the $680,000 per biennium appropriation for the concurrent enrollment grant program is eliminated. On line 72, there's a $500,000 per biennium increase for Direct Admissions Minnesota, which has a corresponding statutory change in Article 2. This increase reflects the costs to the Office of Higher Education estimated in the fiscal note for Senator Gustafson's Senate File 1474. To require all district and charter high schools to participate in direct admissions by the 2029-2030 school year. So the bracketed amounts on line 73 are from the fiscal note and represent the portion of the appropriation on line 72 that's associated with the policy change. On line 80, there's a new $2 million per biennium appropriation for the paramedic scholarship program, which also has a corresponding statutory change in Article 2. This is a modified version of Senator Kupek's Senate File 1940. And this line item previously had a $3.2 million one-time appropriation in fiscal year 24, but did not otherwise have ongoing funding. on line 81, the $540,000 per biennium appropriation for the Hennepin County Medical Center Addiction Medicine Fellowship Program is eliminated. On line 87, there's a $540,000 increase in the 26-27 biennium and a $706,000 increase in the 28-29 biennium for agency administration. This reflects a combination of the governor's recommended operating adjustment for the Office of Higher Education and also the consolidation of the campus sexual assault reporting appropriation. Right below that, on line 88, there's also a placeholder for the fiscal impact of the College Financing Literacy Act, which is Senator Umu Verbaten's Senate File 2932, as amended. This item is included in Article 2, but does not have a direct appropriation, so I've included this line item to track the fiscal impact that OHE would presumably have to absorb somewhere in their budget. But the fiscal note isn't yet complete, so we just don't know how much that will be yet, hence the ellipses. On line 91, there's a $682,000 per biennium increase in the statutory appropriation for post-secondary institution licensing and registration, which has a corresponding revenue increase all the way at the bottom of the spreadsheet on line 208. So those are coupled together. And these are the result of a proposed fee adjustment that was recommended by the governor that's also included in Article 2. General fund transfers to special revenue accounts have been relocated to their own section to comply with updates to our budget rules. But while the section starting on line 93 is new, all of the line items that are in it already existed in the base. On line 96, the $2 million per biennium appropriation for dual training grants for legal cannabis employers is eliminated. These employers are still eligible for grants through the larger dual training grant program on line 95. There just would no longer be an amount designated explicitly for them. On lines 97 and 98, $500,000 of the balance of the dual training account in the special revenue fund is canceled to the general fund in fiscal year 2025 and carried forward as a revenue in 2026, also at the end of the spreadsheet on line 211. That is part of a larger cancellation and reappropriation that I'll come back to when we get to the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities. On line 100, the $750,000 per biennium transfer for the Rural Veterinarian Loan Repayment Program is eliminated. On line 101, the $100,000 per biennium transfer for the Agricultural Educators Loan Repayment Program is eliminated. And on line 102, the $50,000 per biennium transfer for the Aviation Degree Loan Repayment Program is eliminated. All three of these loan repayment program eliminations were proposed in the governor's revised recommendations. So that covers it for the Office of Higher Education. Moving on to the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities, starting on line 106. The A4 proposes total direct general fund appropriations of $1,759,089,000 in the 26-27 biennium, which reflects a $7.7 million increase over base, and $1,758,100,000 in the 28-29 biennium, which reflects a $6.7 million increase over base. This doesn't include any reductions. The appropriations for student tuition relief on line 110, sexual assault reporting policies on line 113, and menstrual products access on line 120 have all been consolidated under other operations and maintenance on line 128. So changes to all four of those line items are net zero. The rider for student tuition relief was previously connected to a tuition freeze requirement that's not included in this budget proposal. And sexual assault reporting policies and menstrual products access are both statutorily required, so the session law riders aren't necessary to ensure that Minnesota State completes that work. So on line 115, there's a $1 million per biennium increase for free course material development and publication. This is a modified version of one of Minnesota State's biennial budget requests. On line 123, there's a $1 million one-time appropriation in fiscal year 26 for PFAS remediation at the Lake Superior College Emergency Response Training Center. This is a modified version of Senator McEwen's Senate File 2044 as amended. And then on lines 125 and 126, the $500,000 appropriation for the Kids on Campus initiative from fiscal year 2024 is canceled in 2025 and carried forward as a revenue in 2026. Also at the end of the spreadsheet on line 212. So in combination with the $500,000 cancellation from the dual training account in the Office of Higher Education, there's a total of $1 million in one-time new revenue to offset the increase for the PFAS remediation work. This portion of the cancellation was also in Senator McEwen's Senate File 2044 as amended. Line 129 reflects the cost to Minnesota State estimated in the fiscal note for Senator Weber's Senate File 164 as amended, which requires the University of Minnesota and Minnesota State to maintain a supply of opiate antagonists in campus residential buildings. This item is also included in Article 2, but doesn't have a direct appropriation. So I've included this line to track the fiscal impact that Minnesota State will have to absorb somewhere in their budget. Along those same lines, lines 130 and 131 are placeholders for the fiscal impact of the College Financing Literacy Act, which is Senator Umover-Baton's Senate File 2932 as amended, and the Enrollment Fraud Working Group, which is Senator Umover-Baton's Senate File 2703. These lines also don't have direct appropriations, so I've included them here to track the fiscal impact that Minnesota State will have to absorb when we know what that fiscal impact is, because the fiscal notes have not yet been completed. On line 135, yeah, I didn't say that very confidently. On line 135, there appears to be a $4.5 million per biennium increase for emergency assistance for post-secondary students grants. But like I mentioned when I spoke about the Office of Higher Education, the portion of the EAPS funding that was previously distributed to Minnesota State through OHE is now being directly appropriated, so it's a net zero change. And then the same is true for hunger-free campus grants on line 136, where there appears to be a $1.2 million per biennium increase. This is also a net zero change. Next is the University of Minnesota, starting on line 142. The A4 proposes total direct appropriations of $1,488,526,000 in each of the 26-27 and 28-29 biennia, and that includes $1,484,212,000 per biennium in the general fund and $4,314,000 per biennium in the healthcare access fund. And that reflects a $5,752,000 per biennium general fund decrease below base and no change from the healthcare access fund base. One thing I want to note up front is that in addition to changes to the appropriations, the A4 also proposes a restructuring of the University of Minnesota section of the bill. Is this in the packets? It is, okay. So in your packets, you should have a crosswalk document that is titled University of Minnesota Rider Reorganization in the upper left-hand corner. This document summarizes where line items are in the A4 amendment in the left column compared to where they were in Senate File 2483 as introduced in the right column. But I'll also just briefly summarize the changes at a higher level. Everything that's in the University of Minnesota section of the bill, both the line items and the amounts, were already being honored this way, in the base, even if they weren't explicitly named in session law. The A4 moves to start naming them again. So that means you may see some things here that are unfamiliar or that maybe you haven't seen in a long time. And that's just because a lot of items that have been rolled up over time have now been unrolled. Next, all of the operations and maintenance riders have been relocated elsewhere, leaving just the unridered amount. So that is what is now just the operations and maintenance line item and in the bill in that section, subdivision 2. And then all of the riders, whether they were formerly O&M and also otherwise, have been reorganized as special appropriations within subdivisions based on major subject areas. So you can see that there are new subdivisions called research and innovation, medical training and care, social sciences, natural resources management and education, and campus management and student support. So I guess to the numbers, on line 143, there appears to be a $1,220,000 per biennium increase for operations and maintenance, but it's actually a net zero change that reflects the consolidation of the $1 million per biennium appropriation for Morris American Indian student tuition waivers on line 191, and $220,000 per biennium appropriation for menstrual products access on line 195. These are both statutorily required, so the session law riders aren't necessary to ensure the university does them. Line 144 reflects the costs to the university estimated in the fiscal note for Senator Weaver's Senate File 164 as amended. And as with Minnesota State, this item is included in Article 2, but doesn't have a direct appropriation. So I've included that line to track the fiscal impact that the university will have to absorb within its budget. And line 145, again, is a placeholder for the fiscal impact of the College Financing Literacy Act, pending a completed fiscal note. On line 150, the $1,408,000 per biennium appropriation for the Research and Innovation Office, which was previously part of the system special appropriation, is eliminated. I'm so sorry, I have to take a drink of water. This is outrageous. Okay. And then on line 156, the $6.5 million per biennium appropriation for cannabis research, which the governor had rolled into operations and maintenance in his budget recommendations, is eliminated. On line 163, there's a new $3 million per biennium appropriation for a partnership between the University of Minnesota Medical School and CentraCare to establish and operate residency programs in St. Cloud and Willmar. This is a modified version of Senator Putnam's Senate File 2516. And this line item previously had a $10 million one-time appropriation in fiscal year 24, but did not otherwise have ongoing funding. On line 173, the $58,000 per biennium appropriation for economic development research, which was previously part of the system special appropriation, is eliminated. On line 174, the $184,000 per biennium appropriation for the Humphrey Forum, which was also previously part of the system special appropriation, is eliminated. On line 182, the $1,692,000 per biennium appropriation for the Minnesota Geological Survey, which was previously part of the College of Science and Engineering appropriation, is eliminated. On line 183, the $280,000 per biennium appropriation for the Bell Museum, which was previously part of the system special appropriation, is eliminated. Flipping to our last page here. Let's see. On line 192, the $588,000 per biennium appropriation for the University of Minnesota Talented Youth Mathematics Program, which was previously a part of the College of Science and Engineering appropriation, is eliminated. On line 196, there appears to be a $1,558,000 per biennium increase for emergency assistance for post-secondary students grants. But as I mentioned when I spoke about the Office of Higher Education and Minnesota State, the portion of the EAPS funding that was previously distributed to the university through OHI is now being directly appropriated. So it's a net zero change. And again, the same is true for Hunger Free Campus on line 197, where there appears to be a $400,000 per biennium increase. This is also a net zero change. Last but not least, there's the Mayo Clinic starting on line 202. The A4 proposes eliminating all funding to Mayo, which is a $3,598,000 per biennium general fund decrease below base. And those reductions encompass both line items in this section, the Mayo Clinic Alex School of Medicine and the Family Medicine Residency Programs. I've already talked about these revenues, so I'm going to pivot a little bit to the A4 amendment itself to highlight the changes in Article 1 that weren't necessarily captured in the spreadsheet. There are just a few, so we're almost there. Okay. On page 1 in section 2, subdivision 2, extended appropriation availability has been added for the appropriations for the state grant program. So these amounts appropriated in 2026 and 2027 will be available until June 30th, 2029. On page 2, in subdivision 8, starting on line 24, there are some changes to the funding distribution language for the Tribal College Supplemental Assistance Grant Program that correspond to statutory changes to this program in Article 2, which we'll get to shortly. Let's see. On page 4, subdivision 17, starting on line 1. This is the change to the emergency assistance for post-secondary students distribution method so that the Office of Higher Education only administers the funding for private and tribal colleges and then direct appropriations for Minnesota State and the University of Minnesota are in their respective sections. And that is the same for the Hunger Free Campus program on page 6, starting on line 28. That program is also changing so that the Office of Higher Education only administers the funding for private and tribal colleges. Let's see. On page 9, line 20, the subdivision 29, the total for inclusive higher education is $1 million, but as I mentioned, there is a new transfer section. So $750,000 of that $1 million total is a transfer to a special revenue account that's been relocated to that section. Similarly, on page 10, starting on line 7, the money for North Star Promise scholarships was relocated to the transfer section, so only the administration amount has a direct appropriation here. So those two portions have just been separated, but they're both still here. Also on page 10, something I want to note about subdivision 35, starting on line 17, is that, excuse me, the authority that the Office of Higher Education has to transfer unencumbered balances from appropriations in this section to certain programs would no longer apply to the special revenue fund transfers that have been moved into their own section because they're not appropriations and they're not in this section. So transfers out of those funds would no longer be authorized by this subdivision. On page 17, in subdivision 3, paragraph C, starting on line 24, the University of Minnesota wanted some flexibility in the appropriations for the medical discovery teams and the Clinical and Translational Science Institute. So we added transfer authority between them so that they can rebalance funding between those two programs as needed. And also more broadly, this is the start of the reorganized University of Minnesota section. And then on page 27, this is the new transfer section. So again, this is nothing new. It's just in a dedicated section now. But if you're looking for something that you know is here, it's possible that it moved to the transfer section, so that's a place to look. And then lastly, for Article 1 on page 28, line 11, this is the cancellation section for those two cancellations from the Kids on Campus Initiative and the dual training account in the Special Revenue Fund to sum to that $1 million appropriation for PFAS remediation at Lake Superior College. With that, I think that covers the appropriations article.
Thanks, Ms. Bush. Members, do we have questions for Ms. Bush? All right, seeing none, Mr. Watson, if you'd talk us through Article 2, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, I'm going to start Article 2 on page 28, Section 1. Requires public and charter high schools to participate in the direct admissions program by the 2029-2030 school year. On that same page, and that comes from Senate File 1474, Section 1. Same page, Section 2, comes from Senate File 2753, permits the Minnesota State Universities to offer the applied doctoral degree in cybersecurity. On page 29, the bottom, Section 3 requires Minnesota State colleges and universities and requests the University of Minnesota to maintain two doses of opiate antagonists in each campus residential building. This comes from Senate File 164. Turning the page to 30, Section 4 comes from Senate File 1035. It requires post-secondary institutions to establish a sexual misconduct grievance process that complies with certain criteria. That bill is in Sections 4 and 5. Section 4 just changes or adds a definition for retaliation. And Section 5 amends the Subdivision 2A to add new requirements for sexual misconduct grievance processes. On page 35, we'll move to Section 6. This makes technical changes in the section of law that provides protections for pregnant and parenting students. This came from the governor's proposal. Section 7 is on page 37. This permits, this also comes from the governor's proposal. This permits the Office of Higher Education to retain up to 5% of competitively awarded grants for administrative costs. Section 8, also on page 37, also comes from the governor's proposal. This consolidates into one report certain reports that the Office of Higher Education is required to provide to the legislature. And there's a list below of the consolidated reports, which I won't read through. Section 9 on page 38, this is Senate File 2932. This requires the Office of Higher Education to create standard terminology and standard templates for colleges and universities to use when sending financial aid offers to prospective and current students. And I'm giving a high-level overview, I'll note, but there's more detail in the bill summary, which is in everyone's packets. That bill, Senate File 2932, appears in here as sections 9 through 13. So we'll move on to section 14. This is a change, and that is on page 44. This is a chair's prerogative based on the amendments that were considered last week to the state grant program parameters. Section 13 amends the definition of assigned family responsibility, which is one of the inputs for calculating a student's financial aid award under the state grant program. Section 14 raises the assigned family responsibility for dependent students to be 90% of the parental contribution, up from current law, which is 79%. And it amends, it changes the way that negative parental contributions and negative student contributions are handled. If the parental contribution is between zero and negative 1500, the assigned family responsibility is 100% of the parental contribution. If it is below negative 1500, the assigned family responsibility is still, it sort of sets a floor at negative 1500, and that same change is made when there's a negative student contribution for an independent student. Section 15 is from the governor's proposal. It amends the eligibility requirements for receiving state student financial aid for private schools that do not participate in the Pell Grant, and it also makes changes to the law for how post-secondary institutions can be removed from the state grant program eligibility if they are terminated from federal financial aid programs. Section 16, which is on page 46, is another change to the state grant parameters, also a chair's prerogative based on the amendments heard last week. This amends the calculation for the cost of attendance, it sets the living and miscellaneous expense allowance was at 115% of federal poverty guidelines, and it lowers that to 110%. Section 17 on page 47 is another change to the state grant parameters, the chair's prerogative. This amends the statute that governs how awards are reduced in the event the legislature has not appropriated sufficient money to fully fund the state grant program. This is really clarifying language to say that, so under current law, OHE must reduce awards by increasing the percentage of the assigned student responsibility and adding a surcharge to the assigned family responsibility. Section 17 clarifies that the AFR may exceed 100% of the federal parent or student contribution once that surcharge is added. Section 18 makes changes to the law that governs how a surplus funds for the state grant program can be distributed. This adds the option for OHE to recognize a lower assigned family responsibility for students who have a negative student or parent contribution. So right now the floor, or in this proposal, the floor would be negative 1500. In the event that there's a parent contribution below that in the future and there's a surplus, OHE could recognize that. Section 19 on page 48 is another amendment to the state grant program, and it reduces the lifetime credit limit that a student can fund with the state grant program from 180 credits to 120 credits. Section 20 on page 48 amends the deadline for applying under the state grant from June 30th of the fiscal year for the school year that has passed to 30 days after the start of a term. This was in the governor's proposal and in some of the amendments heard last week. Section 21 and 22 both come from the governor's proposal. They modify the North Star Promise Program to require the University of Minnesota and the MinState system to charge resident tuition to enrolled students that are eligible for North Star Program. Section 23 on page 49 comes from the governor's proposal, and this makes a technical change to the eligibility requirements for the North Star Program. Section 24 on page 50 is the governor's proposal. This makes a technical change to eligibility requirements for out-of-state colleges and universities to participate in state student loan programs. Section 25 on page 50 amends the law governing the handling of data collected in the Minnesota Supplemental Loan Program, and it prohibits OHE from providing the number of late payments in the previous 12 months by a student to a consumer credit reporting agency. Section 26 makes technical changes to the law governing grants to tribally controlled colleges. That's page 51. That also comes from the governor's proposal. Section 27 on page 52 makes technical changes to the law regarding dual training competency grants. This comes from the governor's proposal. And that is also a change in section 28. Section 29 to 32. These come from the governor's proposal. It starts on page 53. These amend the laws regulating private and out-of-state public post-secondary institutions to make technical changes and to adjust the fee structure that is charged by OHE. And again, there's more detail in the summary. So I'll move on to section 33 to 53. So sections 33 to 53. Section 33 starts on page 59. This amends the laws regulating private career schools, and it modifies the registration requirements and adjusts the fee schedule. There are more details about the changes in the summary, so we'll move forward to section 53. Which is on page 71. Okay, section 53 deletes a requirement that the Office of Higher Education share certain information with middle school and high school students. This is from the governor's proposal. Section 54 on page 72 makes some clarifying changes to the Spinal Cord Injury and Traumatic Brain Injury Research Grant Program to clarify what kinds of institutions can receive grants. Sections 55 and 56 amend the statute governing how funds are distributed out of the Permanent University Fund, which receives royalties from mining under state mineral leases. This comes from SF2881. Section 57, which is on page 74, adds employees of secondary institutions to the list of individuals who may be authorized to administer opiate antagonists. This is also from SF-164, which required universities to keep a provision to keep doses of opiate antagonists in residential buildings. Section 58 comes from the governor's proposal. It increases the amount that is available to the Office of Higher Education through the Small Pool Bond Allocation Program from $10 million to $25 million. Section 59, which is on page 76, amends session law to permanently extend a program to provide scholarships to students entering paramedics programs and the attendant reporting requirements. That section 60 is part of that same change. Section 61 on page 77 establishes a working group to develop policy recommendations to prevent fraudulent enrollment in online courses. This is from SF 2703. Section 62 has certain technical instructions to the reviser of statutes. Section 63 also has technical direction to the reviser of statutes. And Section 64 repeals certain sections of statutes. That's on page 78. Paragraph A repeals statutory language related to the Hunger Free Campus program. This is related to the change that Ms. Bursch talked about. And paragraph B repeals session law in conjunction with codifying the paramedic scholarships program in statute. Paragraph C repeals statutory language requiring individual reports that have been combined in Article 2, Section 9. And paragraph D repeals a rule setting a $500 minimum self-loan amount. And that is the end of my walkthrough.
Thank you, Mr. Watson. Members, questions for Mr. Watson? Seeing, Senator Farnsworth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and also thank you for coming to the Ranger Party yesterday. It's good to see you. That was the most important event of the year, so I had to acknowledge that. I'm wondering on page 49, line 49.16, it says the Board of the Regents of the University of Minnesota and trustees, blah, 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 must adopt a policy to charge resident tuition rates for all students eligible for the North Star Promise. I remember we discussed this, but are we providing North Star Promise to non-Minnesota residents?
Mr. Watson?
I believe this change came from they are all resident students, but the requirements for residency under the North Star program was different than the requirements for residency under the way the university required it. And I think probably the universities could probably speak to that better.
Senator Farnsworth, our first testifier is the commissioner, and I think he might be able to hazard an answer to that question too. That's fair. Thank you so much. Senator Mover Baden.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question's just on page 44, section 14. My understanding is what we're doing is allowing the assigned family responsibility to go above 100% with a surcharge so that the modifiers can sort of stay intact and be different for dependent students, independent students, students with dependents. But I just, I remembered the language in the A2 from Thursday, and I'm just, if you can just help me understand what the language that references if a parental contribution is less than negative 1500, the assigned family responsibility is that new language that I'm seeing in here, what exactly that does.
Mr. Watson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So what this language would do is that if the, so I believe right now parental contribution won't go below negative 1500 under current federal law, but that could change in the future. And so what this language does is it says, it sets basically a floor in the assigned family responsibility of negative 1500. So if in the future someone were to get a parental contribution of negative 1800, that would be, you know, that would be calculated in the statute as negative 1500. And then, but up until that negative 1500, it would be 100% of the parental contribution, so negative 1200.
Senator Weaver-Baden. Members, any other questions for Mr. Watson? All right, seeing none. Hey, it's time for us to hear some public testimony, folks. Here's the deal. We don't have a lot of time, and there's a lot of you who want to talk about this thing. So we're going to go at 2 minutes per testifier, please. And just so you're aware, we're all pretty nice people up here, but Sam is not. He's a cruel, cruel, mean man. And he's going to have a timer that's going to go off, and he's going to give you dirty looks when it does, just so you know. And he's going to give me a dirty look when it does. So, folks, we're aiming for 2 minutes apiece. Of course, Sam and I already negotiated some extra time for the commissioner, so you get 2 minutes and 47 seconds because it's a difficult budget year. So with that being said, let's commence our testimony, if we could, please. Commissioner Olson, if you would. And, folks, I'm going to ask ask us to go up kind of in waves, if we could, for the sake of expediency. So Mr. Bart and Ms. Becker, would you both come up as well, please, so that we're prepared for you when we're ready for you? And Mr. Commissioner Olson, if you would please state your full name for the record and commence your testimony when you're ready.
Yeah, thank you, Vice Chair Putnam. For the record, my name is Dennis Olson. I serve as the Commissioner of the Minnesota Office of Higher Education. To the chair, boy, I'm feeling the pressure, Vice Chair Putnam. Sam. Good afternoon to the chair, who I know isn't here, but Vice Chair Putnam, ranking Member Duckworth, members of the committee, just thanks for the opportunity here to share just a few brief comments on the provisions in the DE on behalf of the Office of Higher Education. First, want to start by thanking you for considering and including many of the governor's budget recommendations in the bill, particularly those that address the projected shortfall in the Minnesota State Grant Program. As I think we're all aware, you know, the governor recommended an additional investment in the state grant program, as well as adjustments to formula parameters necessary to balance the state grant budget and create a more predictable and sustainable award formula for students. We were, of course, happy to see that the committee had a $100 million budget target to work with and chose to invest the majority of those funds into the program, which then requires only slight modifications to parameters in current law. And although there are some differences between the governor's recommendations and those within the bill, they're definitely a move in the right direction. So we appreciate the balanced approach taken by modifying the living and miscellaneous expense allowance and moving the deadline to the 30th day of the term in which a student applies for aid. We at the office also appreciate the flexibility to adjust awards should we face another projected shortfall. And as we've talked a bit in previous testimony, this is also vitally important as we continue to monitor federal funding, of course, particularly related to the instability with the federal Pell Grant program. I want to thank the committee as well for including nearly all the recommended policy provisions, especially those intended to improve the program approval timelines for our licensing and registration division. And I think you know, we know that there's still some small technical updates to be made with some of the policy language overall. We'll certainly commit at the Office of Higher Education to have our subject matter experts available to help clarify and help improve language as the session continues. We do, members, have just a few concerns in the bill, particularly related to some of the proposed reductions and elimination of funding. And we see that you reduced several programs that were not recommended by the governor for reduction or elimination. And we understand you're prioritizing additional investment in some existing programs, as well as investing in new programs that were previously one-time funded. And so again, we look forward to continuing to work with you to retain some of those programs that have been providing supports to students as well as contributing to important research. And then finally, I just want to again thank you for recognizing the budget and policy recommendations from the governor, for including many of them in the bill. We know there's still items that need to be worked through. We look forward to working with the committee and other stakeholders as the bill continues through the process to ultimately create the best bill for Minnesota students. Mr. Vice Chair, that concludes my testimony. I hope I made it under.
Thank you very much, Commissioner. Mr. Bart, if you would please state your full name for the record and commence your testimony when you're ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, committee members. My name is Dr. Gavin Bart, and I direct the Division of Addiction Medicine at Hennepin Healthcare, and I'm also here on behalf of the Family Medicine Training Program at Hennepin Healthcare. Dr. Allison Brotherson has submitted a written testimony. She's our head of family medicine, could not be here. I want to let you know that the proposed elimination of family medicine training dollars will greatly reduce our ability to train family medicine providers who provide primary care throughout Minnesota. And this is especially hard during a workforce shortage. But for addiction medicine, this is devastating. The addiction medicine training program, where we educate and train specialists in addiction medicine, is the only one in the state of Minnesota. And eliminating this budget item will eliminate the program. It won't reduce the scope of our work. It will eliminate the scope of our work, which means we will not have trained specialists who can help treat people with substance use disorder throughout the state of Minnesota. So when a businesswoman in a car crash was transported to Hennepin from one of your communities, and our surgeons and critical care doctors treated her medical conditions. It was addiction specialists who helped treat her prescription pill issue and help her get back to one of your communities, remaining sober, and we were able to hand her off to a trained addiction specialist in that community. And without ongoing funding, we won't be able to provide those trainees to serve the communities in Hibbing or Park Rapids or Lakeville or Minneapolis or St. Paul or St. Cloud or anywhere else in the state. So it is imperative that our trainees and our ability to educate them continues through this funding. We provide in-kind resources in terms of our ability to administratively care for these residents through their training, and all the education we provide in terms of us as professors is an in-kind contribution. The only budget we're asking for is the support for the learners themselves, and I hope you will allow this program to continue on into the future. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Bart. Ms. Specker, if we could, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am Dr. Sheila Specker. I'm an addiction psychiatrist at the University of Minnesota and have been the program director for the Minnesota Addiction Medicine Fellowship for the past 25 years. I want first to thank you for your past support and for Chair Fateh's sponsorship of the bill, which funded this program 2 years ago, and urgently request that you reinstate this appropriation. As Dr. Bart said, our funding has always been tenuous. We do not receive CMS dollars as the residencies do to support the stipends for our fellows. This funding that we have had over the past biennium has allowed us to double the number of physicians trained in addiction and to serve Minnesota, training 8 over the last biennium. 100% of our fellows have become board certified in addiction medicine, which is a testament, I think, to the success of our program. We train fellows in kind of extensively in assessment and treatment of all types of substance use disorders, the heavily co-occurring mental health disorders and medical problems, all ages, adolescent to elderly, diverse populations, and they also learn skills to be able to teach others. Dr. Bart mentioned some of the areas where our graduates work, but I want to emphasize that our physicians become not just excellent clinicians, but also teachers and leaders. We would never be able to train enough physicians to treat all of addiction, but we certainly can train those to be leaders and teachers of others. We have graduates who have gone and provided care to northern Minnesota, southeastern Minnesota, and our own underserved communities, such as the FQHC Community University Healthcare Center in Minneapolis. This past year, we also began establishing partnership with a rural location. We know that physician shortage in rural areas in general is huge, and especially with regard to addiction. To train in rural areas really requires the physicians to go there, and in order to go there, that also requires some support. This is one goal of our program. Also, just last week, I met with a physician, Dr. Ali, who is in the community in South Minneapolis, which is in Chair Fateh's district, who is focusing on the opioid crisis in the Somali population and the Native population. I've met with them. They're hoping to partner with us, but we're not going to be able to do that without assistance from the state. It's important to realize that this is an education program and that there are costs of training. So we do not cover training with the healthcare dollars. We have faculty costs, we have stipends and benefits for the fellows, we have administration and program costs, accreditation, education materials, et cetera. I testified just a few weeks ago to the House Higher Ed Committee, where we were described as a small but mighty program and received their ongoing support. We strongly encourage you to reinstate our base biannual funding of $540,000. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Specker. Up next, you have Ms. Valander, Ms. Gertken, and Mr. Ames. If you would all please come up and take a seat. Folks, remember on the two-minute limit situation, if you have more you want to say, feel free to submit extra testimony in writing, please. Ms. Valander, if you would please state your full name for the record and commence your testimony when you're ready.
Great. Thanks, Mr. Chair, and good job on the name. Mr. Chair, members and staff, thank you for the opportunity to speak to you today. My name is Nikki Valander, and I'm the Director of Government Relations here in Minnesota for Mayo Clinic. For background, Mayo Clinic is the largest integrated not-for-profit medical group practice in the world. We are committed to clinical practice, research, and education. We aim to constantly achieve our primary value of the needs of the patient come first. The needs of our patients span the spectrum of care from the most primary to the most complex. Our research efforts strive to achieve translational advancements that result in earlier diagnoses and new cures. And our School of Medicine and Sciences focuses on training and supporting more than 4,300 individuals across 5 schools and more than 450 educational programs. I'd like to thank the committee for the ongoing support of the innovative research partnerships between the state, the University of Minnesota, and Mayo Clinic related to medical genomics, biotechnology, and regenerative medicine. These partnerships have led to startup companies, clinical trials, new technology patents, and innovations, which the committee heard about earlier this year. As you consider potential changes to your proposal and soon begin negotiations with the House, I would respectfully ask for your consideration and continued support for family medicine residency programs, including the 42 medical residency residents and family medicine residents in Mankato and Rochester-Cassin, and the Minnesota-based medical students attending the Mayo Clinic Alex School of Medicine. The state's previous and current support of these programs have helped underscore the significant investment needed to train our future and upcoming healthcare providers. Mayo is proud to educate and train these important members of our community and would ask for the state's continued recognition and support. So in closing, I'd like to thank you again for your ongoing commitment to driving innovative medical and scientific research by the appropriations found on lines 153 and 154 of your spreadsheet. And I would also ask that you reconsider and enact support for all family medicine residencies and direct support to medical students, including reestablishing funding for the programs found on lines 203 and 204 of your budget sheet. So thank you for your consideration of this testimony, and I would welcome the opportunity to continue to work with you.
Thank you, Ms. Valander. Ms. Gertken, is it?
Nailed it.
If you would please state your full name for the record.
Yes, good afternoon, Vice Chair Putnam and committee members. My name is Jody Gertken, and I am the Director of State Government and Community Relations for CentraCare. I'm here today to testify in support of Senate File 2483 and the DE Amendment, specifically Article 1, Section 4, Subdivision 4. As you are aware, CentraCare and the University of Minnesota Minnesota Medical School, have partnered to develop a medical school campus in St. Cloud to train medical students to serve rural communities throughout the state. Through this partnership, CentraCare is poised to create several rural residency programs and tracks to address the physician shortage facing rural communities. These leaders will benefit from the well-established programs at the university, coupled with experiences at CentraCare's clinical sites in Greater Minnesota for world-class training with a rural emphasis. The rural health academic affiliation between our organizations explicitly aims to expand graduate medical education in multiple areas of specialty training to serve the needs and the interests of rural Minnesota. These include family medicine, pediatrics, psychiatry, internal medicine, general surgery, obstetrics, and gynecology. These programs will also focus on care for underserved populations and equip residents to address healthcare disparities. By providing robust residency options, CentraCare aims to build a pipeline of skilled physicians who have had training specifically focused on rural practice and stay and serve locally. So, in closing, I'd like to thank you, Vice Chair Putnam, for your continued support and advocacy on behalf of CentraCare and this committee for being an integral part of making this transformational work a reality. So, we sincerely thank you for your support and as well as all residencies through the state.
You have 13 seconds left.
I timed myself earlier.
Mr. Ames, if you would please.
Thank you, Vice Chair Putnam and members of the committee. I'm Trevor Ames, a veterinarian representing the Minnesota Veterinary Medical Association today. And We're here opposing the elimination of funding for the Minnesota Rural Veterinary Loan Forgiveness Program. I spent my veterinary career until retirement at the University of Minnesota College of Veterinary Medicine, including serving 12 years as dean of the college. And during that time, I worked with Senator Dill, who's also a veterinarian, to get this loan forgiveness program established in 2009. This history has given me a unique perspective and vantage point to understand and assess the overwhelming success of this program. In the last 6 years alone, the program has helped about 40 graduates with their student loans and incentivized approximately 95% of them to stay in rural practice areas throughout the state. A review of data also shows 100% utilization of the funds available over that time frame. That's an amazingly successful program by any measure. The rural veterinary workforce shortage is real. It affects all Minnesotans living in rural areas of the state, whether they're livestock owners or love their companion animals. Lack of veterinary services affects their quality of life in rural communities, and more importantly, it affects the economic viability of our livestock and poultry industries, which represent a major economic strength of the state. Rural veterinarians are often the first line of defense against any introduction of a new animal disease entering our state. Solving complex problems like the rural veterinary shortage requires many solutions, and the Minnesota Rural Veterinary Loan Forgiveness Program has played an important role in alleviating the problem. We must continue to recruit our students from rural areas, train them to serve well in those areas, incentivize these new graduates to stay in rural areas for at least 5 years, and ensure proper mentorship after they graduate as they begin their work in rural areas. Research has shown that by doing these things, we are much more successful in having veterinary graduates go to and stay in rural areas for their career. The Minnesota Veterinary Medical Association, USDA, the College of Veterinary Medicine, and the state of Minnesota all play important roles in resolving this issue. The college has programs addressing recruitment of rural students, excellent training to ensure their success after graduation, and scholarships targeting students interested in rural practice. The Minnesota Veterinary Medical Association has job fairs, scholarships, and also mentors new graduates. And even USDA has its own loan forgiveness programs, as it too recognizes the needs for rural veterinarians. As I stated earlier, complex problems require many solutions, and the groups listed are making a difference. In summary, I'm confident in saying the Minnesota Rural Veterinary Loan Forgiveness Program has been an astounding success, and I ask you to keep funding this for rural Minnesota's economy and quality of life. Thank you.
Thank you very much, all three of you. Now, if we could have Mr. Toramoro, Mr. Goldman, and Mr. Oman all please come to the desk. Mr. Toramoro, if you please state your full name for the record commence your testimony when you're ready.
Yeah. Thank you, Vice Chair Podman and members of the committee. My name is Dr. Monse Torremorel, and I'm a veterinarian, and I also serve as the chair of the Department of Veterinary Population Medicine at the College of Veterinary Medicine. I'm not here today representing the University of Minnesota, but rather I'm testifying based on my experiences working with veterinarians in rural areas of Minnesota. I'm also here representing veterinary students and new graduates that depend on this program, and deciding whether to move or not to rural areas, really this program makes a difference. So it's key to the efforts that we have to recruit and retain veterinarians in rural Minnesota. Losing this program will jeopardize rural veterinary services, especially at a time when maintaining a robust veterinary workforce is more important than ever. Rural areas already face severe shortages of foot animal veterinarians, and without this funding, committees will struggle to find qualified professionals to care for livestock, protect public health, and also to take care of the pets that, you know, the members of those communities have. As you know, working in rural areas as a veterinarian is not easy. It's hard. It's very demanding. And yet veterinarians are part of the first line of response when it comes to biosecurity, emerging preparedness, and disease response. Just think about what's happening right now with high path avian influenza and the impact on eggs and more. I want to share just some comments that some of the students made as I was preparing for this. So when they learned that I was going to be here to testify and defend the program, they actually got frustrated and disappointed just at the thought that this program could get lost. For many students, having access to this program makes a difference in going back to those communities and moving back to the rural areas where many of these students come from those areas. Makes the difference to them on whether they will establish their own practice or not, makes the difference on whether they will be able to stay after a certain number of years of having moved in those areas or not. They want to contribute to those communities, they want to stay in those rural areas, and this program is very important for that. So rather than eliminating this crucial funding, we should be expanding it to strengthen the veterinary workforce and support rural communities, protect, obviously, public health and food security. So more now than ever, we cannot afford to lose this program. This program is part of a comprehensive strategy, again, to recruit and retain veterinarians. So thank you for your attention today.
Thank you, Dr. Tarmo. Mr. Goldman, please state your full name for the record and commence your testimony when you're ready.
Great. Vice Chair Putnam. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. For the record, my name is Greg Goldman. I'm the Executive Vice President for Finance and Operations and Chief Financial Officer at the University of Minnesota. On behalf of President Rebecca Cunningham, I want to begin by expressing our appreciation for the committee's continued support of higher education. We recognize the current and upcoming constraints on the state budget, and we're grateful that you are able to maintain our base funding for operations and maintenance. That said, I do want to take a moment to raise awareness about the reductions or eliminations in the state's special accounts. The reality is we do not have discretionary resources available to absorb these costs internally, and as a result, some programs will have to be scaled back or sunsetted entirely. Longstanding programs not tied to our core missions, but have marginal statewide research, including the Minnesota Geological Survey, the Talented Youth Mathematics Program, the Humphrey Forum, and the Center for Economic Development would likely end. A reduction of $140,000 per year for the Bell Museum, the state's legislative designated natural history museum, will have challenging impacts on their operations. Reductions to general research within the graduate school will shrink an internal funding pool used to seed promising research across disciplines, often helping our faculty secure federal or industry partnerships. And the elimination of $6.5 million in cannabis research funding will have direct impacts to our school's public health, school public health's ability to lead in this emerging and complex field. We remain committed to being transparent stewards of public funds and ensuring our work continues to benefit communities across Minnesota in the most efficient and impactful way possible. Again, thank you for your partnership in maintaining our base funding for operations and maintenance. We look forward to our continuing work with you and your staffs as we enter the final weeks of the legislative session. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Goldman. Now, Mr. Oman, if you would please.
Mr. Chair, Senators, my name is Bernie Oman with Minnesota State Colleges and Universities, and I want to thank the committee for listening to the many issues that were brought forward by our students, our faculty, our campuses, and on behalf of the communities we serve. I also want to thank you for the collegiality that you have given to all the folks that have come in front of your committee. And even more importantly, seeing the collegiality that you have to one another is a fine reflection of the leadership of this committee on both sides of the aisle. And I will say this as someone who has resided my entire life few miles from St. John's, I have appreciated the Tommy Johnny thing because those of us that live there know that the Johnnies all want to be Huskies anyway. Just saying. We appreciate you including the cybersecurity added to our portfolio in our applied doctorate offerings, the support you're going to give to Lake Superior College as they're struggling through cleanup of a significant PFAS issue at their campus, and also the ongoing support that we will be able to do as far as the work with our textbooks. And coming into this session, Minnesota State leadership certainly understood the financial position that the state was in, and we thank you for the work that you've done to get a positive target, and hopefully that the House will eventually move, and we will continue to nudge them to move into that direction. Obviously, as it relates to the budget, no base increase coupled with financial pressures. We are fully acknowledging that the road ahead will be difficult, and in the months ahead, I think we all can acknowledge that we're going to need space to do that work at our campuses to reconcile their budgets. And it is very probable that from what we are seeing with the budget reconciliation process in Washington, D.C., that we will probably be back in front of you working that through as early as this fall, because some of those reductions that are being talked about will have significant impacts on the campuses and the communities we serve. Finally, let me just say thank you to the staff for the work that you did in putting the budget together and making it very clear as you crafted the budget, and to Sam for helping us navigate this process in the Senate side. We're very appreciative of all that work.
Thank you, Mr. Oman. Now, if our next slate could be Mr. Cirkvenik, Ms. Horning, and Mr. Frazier, please. Mr. Cirkvenik, if you could please state your full name for the record and commence your testimony when you're ready.
Vice Chair Putnam, Ranking Member Duckworth, and committee members, thank you for the opportunity to testify. My name is Paul Cirkvenik, and I serve as the president of the Minnesota Private College Council. I've submitted a letter to the committee with our views on several issues in the bill, and I just want to note that a group of student leaders from our institutions has submitted a letter sharing their perspectives on the bill. We have a student testifier here today, and we have a representative coming from St. Kate's to address the child care grant provisions of the bill. So I want to be really short and say two words: thank you. Thank you for investing and making a priority for the state grant program. The investment you've made is going to make a tremendous difference for students who rely on state grants to enroll in college and complete a college degree. The students who have the biggest financial barriers to overcome in their pursuit of higher education. So, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Cirkvenik. Ms. Horning, if you would please.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair, members of the committee. My name is Shay Horning, and I serve as the Director of State Affairs for the Undergraduate Student Government at the University of Minnesota Twin Cities. I want to start by also saying thank you for genuinely listening to student voices. This committee has made a real effort to uplift our voices. It's something that I have noticed and have been extremely grateful for in my time serving in student government. We are especially grateful for the protections you've included for students with negative student aid index scores. Thank you for prioritizing aid where it will have the greatest impact, helping low-income students at public colleges afford school and graduate with less debt. I want to highlight the importance of including the student aid award letter reforms in the omnibus bill. When we buy a car or a house, we're given upfront pricing, but when students try to understand the cost of college, it's often a guessing game. Right now, 91% of colleges either leave out or understate the true net price. Many include loans as if they were grants. This leaves students, especially low-income and first-gen students, making huge financial decisions in the dark. Improving student aid award letters reform would change that by requiring clear, consistent, and transparent financial aid offers. This is not a burden. It's basic consumer protection. We also thank you for continuing funding programs like Hunger Free Campus and emergency assistance grants. Nearly one in five UMN students experiences food insecurity. These programs are lifelines. No student should have to choose between attending class and eating dinner. But here's the reality. When the state cuts the U's budget to send a message, it's not administrators who suffer, it's us. And when you fund institutions with the promise that they won't raise tuition and then they do it anyway, students are still the ones who pay the price. We feel it in our tuition bills, in our housing insecurity and our need to work longer hours just to stay enrolled. Please keep that in mind as you negotiate the final bill, and especially when you vote on who our next regents will be. Members of the committee, thank you again for standing with students. This bill makes meaningful progress towards transparency, affordability, and dignity for Minnesota students. We urge you to keep pushing forward and to continue putting students first. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Horning. Mr. Frazier, if you would please state your full name for the record and commence your testimony when you're ready.
Thank you, Chair. It's great to be here today with members of the Higher Ed Committee. My name is Brendan Frazier, and thank you for having me. I'm here today to share my personal story and testimony in regards to the state grant. First, I'd like to say thank you to the Higher Ed Committee for the efforts that you have made to ensure students receive state funding to pursue their higher education. I want to say for the investment for $105 million in the state grant means that students are able to access college and education, and higher education is a reality for these students. Currently for myself, I am a Concordia University student. It's a small institution here in the Twin Cities where I'm majoring in sociology with a double major in political science and international studies. During my time at university, I've accomplished a lot that I'm very proud of. I've been successful in my academics, I've performed in our theater and arts program, and I'm currently running for student body president. Vote for Brendan, wherever the cameras are. In addition to that, I've also been an active member of my community on and off campus. However, despite my successes in school, higher education has not always been a reality for me or obtainable. I come from a low-income family with a single mother and two older sisters. Anyone who has sisters can probably understand my feelings. In addition to that, I've learned that when you come from a low-income background, big dreams are not always realistic. And at a young age, you cannot afford to not be realistic. And some dreams you keep, some dreams you let go. And that is why I'm here today. I'm here to advocate for those students. Being the first in my family to attend university means that I had to navigate a lot by myself. And I found university in Concordia University, a community where I felt supported. And that's why I chose that. Go Golden Bears. In addition to that, I stand before you today thanks to the state grant, scholarships, and additional financial aid. I'm currently in my third year in my school year, currently campaigning for student body president, as I said before, and I aspire to make my family proud, especially as a first-generation student. I am the first in my family to do many things, but I don't intend on being the last. Advocating for the state grant means advocating for those alongside me, the other students, the ones who are not able to access higher education due to financial issues, students like myself who are forced to have realistic expectations. As esteemed members of the committee, members who care about higher education accessibility, you understand the responsibility of being realistic. Budgets are moral documents, and I honor that. However, right now, higher education has a price tag, one with a lot of zeros, as you stated earlier. Financial burden remains to be the number one concern for students, and for those students who choose not to or choose to apply for higher education, it's a reality that they must check. So thank you for investing in the state grant and in the students like myself who rely on the state grant as part of our financial aid package. Ensuring those awards remain as close as possible to the original grant will alleviate the financial burden of higher education for many students. This committee has the ability of making dreaming realistic for students whose social mobility feels inaccessible. So thank you. Let's continue to invest in students. Let's continue to invest in higher education. Let's continue to invest in the future. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Frazier, and the committee wishes you well in your electoral prospects.
Thank you, Chair. How was I on time, Chair?
Sam forgot to start the clock.
I had an opportunity.
So I think that means you did pretty well.
Thank you, committee. Thank you very much. Thanks.
Folks, Ms. Hamer, Mr. Shaver, and Mr. Metcalf, if you would all please come up to the desk.
That's awesome.
Just don't talk to me, pay.
You get paid to be here? Ms. Hamer, if you would please state your full name for the record and commence your testimony when you're ready.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair and members. My name is Beth Hamer, and I serve as the Director of the Access and Success Office at St. Catherine University. Thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of the $2 million increase in the Minnesota Post-Secondary Child Care Grant. If you're not aware, St. Kate's is located, that's our AKA, St. Kate's is among the largest women's university in the country in St. Paul, with over 3,500 students enrolled, 93% of whom identify as women. Founded by the Sisters of St. Joseph of Carondelet, who believed women of all backgrounds deserve access to higher education, St. Kate's continues to welcome a diverse student body, including student parents, to its Baccalaureate College for Women, as well as the College for Adults and Graduate College, which enrolls both men and women. There are over 600 student parents attending St. Kate's across all degree levels. The majority are pursuing degrees through our College for Adults and graduate programs. Access and Success serves as the primary support office for St. Kate's student parents, staffed by licensed social workers who provide confidential support for any pregnant and/or parenting student in need of help with their academic, financial, and family concerns, including locating and paying for childcare. We also offer intensive case management for single-parent students in need of wraparound support, regular support groups, and resource and referrals to on-campus and broader community services related to housing, childcare, food support, and other financial issues. One of the consistent barriers student parents succeeding in college encounter is money. Money for childcare, housing, food, car repairs, etc. St. Kate's student parent recipients of the Minnesota Post-Secondary Child Care Grant report lower stress related to the financial burden of childcare costs, enabling them to complete college and improving their family's economic future. Like most parents, St. Kate's student parents are seeking reliable, trustworthy childcare, whether through a licensed provider or a loving family member who is able to care for their students' children. In the last three academic years, St. Kate's has provided the child care grant to a range of 28 to 32 student parents a year. At St. Kate's, our financial aid office processes and awards the child care grant, while Access and Success staff partner with them by publicizing, educating, and referring student parents for the grant. We also, in Access and Success, manage emergency grant funds for basic needs, such as food and housing payments. And we also received a Student Parent Support Initiative grant recently that can help with childcare for required internship and clinical hours. There's a mix of students whose childcare costs are fully covered by the Minnesota Post-Secondary Child Care Grant, and those who have a gap in what the grant covers and actually they owe for childcare. Further, we typically do not have enough funds for our student parents enrolled in summer session. This increase of $2 million will more adequately fund the Minnesota Post-Secondary Child Care Grant and allow more St. Kate's student parents to participate in this program, reduce ongoing financial stressors, and help student parents perform better academically, graduate on time, and begin moving their families towards financial stability. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Hamer. Mr. Shaverfoot, please state your full name for the record and commence testimony when you're ready.
Chair Putnam, members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is Matt Shaver. I'm the Senior Policy Director at Ed Allies. We're advocates for students. Thank you for the opportunity to share our thoughts on the Chair's omnibus proposal. We're thrilled to see the inclusion of the direct admissions expansion in Article 2, Section 1. Direct admissions widens the door of opportunity for students, and this proposal will move our whole state with the deliberate speed our kids deserve to ensure that every student in Minnesota attends a direct admissions high school before the end of the decade. Thank you, Chair Fate, for recognizing the value in this program. Thank you to OHE for your excellent management of this wildly successful program. Thank you, Senator Duckworth, for your support of Senator Gustafson's bill as well. I also want to share our support for the inclusion of the financial aid standardization policy in Articles 2, Sections 9 through 13. This will make post-secondary opportunities much easier to navigate for students and families. Ed Allies also has a long track record of supporting efforts to pay student teachers for their work and have supported investments in the underrepresented student teacher grant, the shortage area student teacher grant, and the student teacher pilot in the K-12 budget. All three efforts have admirable intent and solid funding, like the proposal in Article 1, Section 2, Subdivisions 18 and 19. Unfortunately, they all fall short of actually paying pre-service teachers for their work. The barrier is that, as currently designed, these dollars flow through the higher ed institution, so it's treated as a form of financial aid rather than pay for the very real work that student teachers do. Their stipend ends up getting gobbled up by fees and tuitions. So we urge this committee to consider not just how much to invest in this area, but how to revamp programs and design a policy that just pays student teachers. And finally, I just want to make a quick note on the working group to combat fraudulent enrollment in online courses, the so-called ghost students in Article 2, Section 61. This is a great idea, but I think in order to draw the attention the topic deserves, it just needs a catchy name. And I'd like to humbly propose that the amending the title with the acronym Ghostbusters, which would stand for Group Helping Outwit Scammers Targeting Budgets Unfairly Stealing Tuition, Examining Realistic Solutions. No bad ideas in a brainstorm. I am embarrassed how much time I spent thinking of that. If anybody can beat it, though, let me know. Thank you again to this committee for being so welcoming to advocates from the K-12 space. We have to continue working together to break down silos between high school and post-secondary so all our students can thrive. And there are many policies in this omnibus that are aligned with that goal. Thank you for that, Chair Fate and members, and thank you all for your public service to the state.
Thank you, Mr. Shaver. Also, 10 extra credit points, and you get an extra 15 seconds if you want them, because that was pretty fun. All right, Mr. Metcalf, if you would please state your full name for the record and commence testimony when we're ready.
My name is Casey Metcalf, Government Relations Manager at Students United. Thank you, Vice Chair Putnam. Thank you, Ranking Member Duckworth, and all members of the committee. I'm going to keep things pretty short. I just want to start by saying, like, at Students United, we bring students together from all these universities in the fall, and we tell them that the customer is always right, that students have the best line of sight into what the things that universities provide. And from those conversations, we heard basic needs over and over and over again. Basic needs for food, basic needs for medicine, life-saving medicine like naloxone. And we also heard about barriers to a college education, whether that be through financial aid or through the application process itself. So I'm thankful for your work in streamlining the process of college admission through the direct admissions process. We're really supportive of that work. We're thankful for OHI's work and for your work in putting it in this bill. I also want to say thank you for access to naloxone in college dorms. This has been a multi-year campaign that maybe hasn't come before you, but it is something that our students have been talking about for the last five to six years, whether that's in their student governments. At Mankato, I want to shout out in particular, MSU Mankato student government has been working on this for a very long time, and Moorhead as well. Very, very hard work that culminates here, but it really goes back to students. So that's all I have, but thank you for your work this session. And yeah, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Metcalf. Ms. Guerrera? You know the drill, but if you could please state your full name for the record and commence testimony when you're ready.
Yes, good afternoon, Chair and members, and thank you for the opportunity to testify. My name is Ariana Shimon, and I am the Interim Executive Director at Foster Advocates. I always enjoy visiting this particular committee, but I have to say I was especially eager to make the trip here today and have the chance to share my deep gratitude to each of you. To see the increase to the base appropriation for FIG is a huge step. The small chance that FIG will officially be sustainable, well, today my team and I are filled with hope. In my previous testimony a few weeks ago, I shared how easy it is to get caught up in all of the failures and the problems of our systems, because the positives are not easy to find. But when you find one, like FIG, it's critical we protect it and we see it through. As you know, FIG has provided Fosters an opportunity for an education and an opportunity to create real stability in their lives. FIG is a true investment. It's the biggest investment that we as a state have made in Fosters and their futures. FIG is special. FIG is changing lives. We have been collecting stories from FIG recipients throughout the state on how FIG has impacted them. One student shared, "My hope is that FIG's benefits continue so that other Fosters are able to experience obtaining an education while also taking back their youth, as I have." Of all the promises we have broken for Fosters as a state, this is one we can find a way to keep. And by making FIG whole, we can do just that. If secured this legislative session, what does that really mean? It means the Office of Higher Education will not have to initiate a waitlist next year. Nearly 700 students who are currently receiving FIG will be secured for fall and spring semesters moving forward. No more coming back to you all here at the legislature to plead for this promise to be fulfilled. No more looming wait lists. Fosters will be able to be students and focus on school. So thank you for seeing and hearing the need to fully fund the Fostering Independence Grant and make it whole. Special thank you to Senator Rarick for your leadership on this transformational program since day one. To Chair Fate for your listening ear and incredible support of FIG. To our partners at the Office of Higher Education, and to the one and only Sam Parmakar. On behalf of my foster community, thank you so much.
There's only one of you? I know. Thank goodness there's only one of him. thank you, Ms. Shimo, for your testimony. I apologize for using an inappropriate last name, but thanks for being here. Members, that's the end of our scheduled testimony for the day. We can have a brief conversation about kind of high-level ideas if you really want to, but we come back on Thursday to really get into the details. So we will open it up to conversation if you'd like to have some, but again, recall we're going to be doing this on Thursday. Senator Mover-Baden.
Thank you. I just had one question for the commissioner.
Commissioner Olson.
So I'm looking at the language that we've included to allow the assigned family responsibility to exceed 100%, and that would be with the addition of a surcharge. And I think the intention, right, is that if you were at, you know, 79 before we add a 25, you know, percent surcharge, you're up at 104. And then the folks who were at 71 and 35, you know, would have the corresponding change. Can you just confirm that's also your intention, or would you have the ability to change the surcharge amounts between the three different categories? Do you understand what I'm saying? Because that's essentially what the governor's proposal was. And so just wanting that clarification that that's how he is interpreting it.
Commissioner Olson.
Yeah, thank you, Vice Chair, Senator Mover-Baden. Yeah, and I understand your question. I do think we need to probably analyze the provision a little bit more, honestly, the language within the bill, because the bill also does instruct the modifier for dependent students to increase to 90% already. And yeah, I do remember the testimony from the University of Minnesota recommending that if that was to exceed 100%, it would kind of do so uniformly 25% for all three modifiers. I believe it brought the dependent to 104. So yeah, with one currently sitting at 90 in the bill, we would have to, you know, understand the impacts, knowing that there's quite a bit of financial difference between the modifiers as well, with dependents carrying the bulk of that cost.
Senator Mover-Baden.
Thank you. Yeah, that is a good flag. I missed that as I was just trying to do quick numbers. So it would be like if we're setting the new kind of base right now at 90, 71, 35, then they would move up to 115 with my example of 25% surcharge. So just something I would like us to look at so that there's clarity, because that was one of my biggest concerns. And I think it's a good proposal as long as that's applied equally across the three different categories.
Senator Duckworth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll be brief and I'll share most of my comments, I think, probably on Thursday, but I just wanted to also speak to a holistic conversation and the folks that are in the room, a lot of stakeholders, and given the testimony that we heard today. First off, I appreciate the optimism of the bill coming from the Senate. But the reality of the situation is we're getting closer and closer to the point in time in which a small group of people are going to make some very important decisions regarding higher education in the state of Minnesota and its funding levels. And right now you kind of have an idea of where things may fall. In the Senate, you see a bill that over the next 2 years would allocate $125 million additionally to higher education. The governor, I think, comes in at about 28.3 over 2 years, and the House is at zero over 2 years. So we've got some work to do. And I have a really tough time looking at things in silos. And so I just want to encourage all of us and those that go on to have those conversations to remember a couple of things. First and foremost, please don't make the conversation about public students versus private students. The conversations are about students regardless. And at the end of the day, if we're facing tough decisions when it comes to cuts or altering budgets, I would please encourage those folks to not penalize students and families. Cuts or changes to budgets should be aimed at two primary things: state government and excess in any institutions out there, not jacking up tuition on students and families, and not continuing to change parameters that award them less help when it comes to meeting the needs they have financially as it relates to college and tuition. I commend this bill for prioritizing the state grant. And at the end of the day, whatever target is agreed upon, if there is one, I hope and pray that almost all of it, the bulk of it, just goes to the state grant to help as many students and families as possible. It's no secret that the state of Minnesota is looking at a $6 billion deficit in the not-too-distant future. That should not be borne on the backs of students and families. The state needs to fix the financial situation it got itself in by making some drastic cuts and reductions to itself and its operations, not by making college more expensive for students and families, or one group of students and families versus another. So all that to say that I hope we can continue to, like was mentioned before, operate in a good bipartisan way, because we've got a lot of work to do in the not-too-distant future. And if you are a leader of a state agency or college, university, or institution, you've really got to start looking at the numbers right now and making some of the changes that are going to be necessary over the next few years, so we're not caught flat-footed and doing things that unfortunately come at the detriment of our students. That's all I've got, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Members, any other questions or comments? Great. Seeing none, there being no further business before the committee, we'll see you Thursday. We're adjourned.